Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 105, The Psychology of Doing Good, August 10th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
You know, in the final analysis, if we can pass the torch of love to the people around us, if we can light a candle in the darkness, if we can encourage our kids to live lives of love, they are going to live happier and healthier, and odds are longer lives. The idea of love being a source of buoyancy and fulfillment, that's the image I want. I don't want any of this arid, dry stuff, you know, the emaciated, masochistic do-gooder. I want us to understand scientifically that we're wired to do unto others, and when we do that, we experience a fuller life.
That was the voice of my guest, Stephen Post, Ph.D., lead author of the 2007 book, Why Good Things Happen to Good People, the exciting new research that proves the link between doing good and living a longer, healthier, happier life. Dr. Post has written 7 scholarly books on unselfish love and giving and is the editor of 8 other books. He's professor of bioethics and family medicine in the School of Medicine, Case Western Reserve University. He's also president of the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love, Altruism, Compassion, Service, which was founded in 2001 with a generous grant from the John Templeton Foundation. He's published over 140 articles in peer-reviewed journals representing the sciences, religion, and humanities. Dr. Post received the Distinguished Service Award from the National Board of the Alzheimer's Association. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Stephen Post, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Well, David, I couldn't be any place better.
Okay, well, that's good. Your latest book, Good Things Happen to Good People, seems to be definitely in step with Martin Seligman's work and all that's happening in the emerging field of positive psychology. Yet you've really been on this path on your own since you were in secondary school, haven't you?
Well, that's right. I have been fortunate in life because when I was thrown out of my home and cast up into the middle of New Hampshire as a poor 13-year-old boy at a church-related high school, I had this wonderful teacher up there named Johnny Walker.
An unlikely name for somebody in a church school if people don't know Johnny Walker is also a whiskey, right?
That's right. So this was the Reverend John Walker, who eventually became the head of the National Cathedral. And he was an African-American, and he understood Howard Thurman and Benjamin Elijah Mays and Martin Luther King's work very well. So I had him to encourage me in thinking about the nature of love and even the metaphysics of love. And there were lots of other good folks up there, too. So I developed a lifelong interest that I've been able, thank heavens, to maintain, but in all sorts of different kinds of venues, science and religious studies and working with the deeply forgetful over the years and now running an institute for research on unlimited love.
Yes, I see that you have that foundation, the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love, and in just 6 years, you've funded over 50 studies at 44 major universities. Now, that's pretty remarkable.
Well, thanks. It's growing all the time, and we've gotten a lot of support from a lot of foundations and individuals to study unselfish giving at its best in human experience, looking at the brain, looking at human development, looking at evolutionary biology and psychology, looking at where philosophy and theology and ethics fit into the picture, trying to understand love in all its aspects. And love, simply put, is as follows. When the happiness and security of another person means as much to me as my own happiness and security, I love that person.
Yeah. You know, I couldn't help but think, though, that the Institute for Research on Unlimited Love might sound a bit on the wimpy side to some ears. What's the justification for focusing on such a weak-sounding, insubstantial thing as, quotes, unlimited love?
Well, listen, you know, okay, so unlimited love is about a remarkable human strength to expressed in a palpable sense an abiding love for others, even those who are not near and dear, but rather just among the neediest, a love that seems to be resilient, even in times of intergroup hatred and violence, a love that can confront harmful, destructive, and self-destructive behaviors, and yet still remain loving, a kind of love that doesn't worry too much about reciprocal gains or reputational gains, but just loves and let everything else take care of itself. So, kind of love that gets people down to New Orleans after Katrina, or makes our otherwise competent medical students great healers. It's the kind of love that parents have for their kids, and that God's supposed to have for everybody.
Well,
so it is a little ambitious.
Mm-hmm, yeah, it's very ambitious. And, I was a bit tongue-in-cheek with my provocative question there about it sounding wimpy. And and your book really goes a long way towards countering any such suggestions, because you cite a tremendous amount of research that actually supports the idea that giving, in particular, as a manifestation of love, that giving can lead to health benefits and lengthen our lives and so many other positive outcomes. One of the things that I was interested to read in your book is that your work evolved out of research that you had been doing on Alzheimer's. Can you tell us a little bit how that evolution happened?
Oh, sure. Well, I spent from 1988 until about 1999, working in the world of the deeply forgetful, both in the Alzheimer's chapters around the country and in Canada, but also as a professor here in the medical school, studying the ways in which caregivers express love to persons with dementia, also looking at the ways in which people with dementia express love. So I have all sorts of memorable stories, one of which involves a man named Jim, who was out at a nursing home in Chardon, Ohio, called Heather Hill. I sat down with Jim, having read his biographical statement on the wall. I knew he had two sons, so I asked him, "Jim, how are your boys?" He couldn't respond at all, because, frankly, his communication system was far gone. However, he had a little branch in his hand, and he handed the branch to me and then smiled so effusively that if warmth were electric, the place would have been on fire. I asked the nurse what was the story with Jim. She said, well, he grew up on a farm in Ohio, and he loved his father very, very much. So he had gone back in time. And it turns out that the chore his father gave him every morning was to bring kindling in for the fireplace. So that stick that Jim gave me that day in the nursing home was a symbol of the love that he felt from his father and the safety that he felt in the context of that love and attachment. So love is a resurrection of a sort, even for the most deeply forgetful and for the people who care for them.
I really like that term that you use for Alzheimer's, the deeply forgetful. That sounds like a very caring term.
Well, I hope so. And the other thing is that we get a sense of our own position on a continuum, because believe me, you know, we're all a little forgetful.
I am.
I am, at least since we declined from about age 24 or 25, actually. And, you know, we have all sorts of things that we forget as we get into our 50s. That's not dementia, but it's normal age-related forgetfulness. I like to say, it's okay to forget where you parked your car, but it's not okay to forget that you have a car that's parked. That's the difference.
Yeah, this morning I caught myself from pouring the orange juice on my cereal instead of the milk.
Ah, that's a good one.
Yeah, and it's not the first time, but fortunately I caught myself this time just in time. You know, that story that you shared reminds me of a story that you both begin and close your book with, a kind of touchstone, about the bus trip that you took.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Yeah, tell us that story.
Milesburg. See, I had a terrible business meeting in New York City in the late summer of 2003. I couldn't get any place with this meeting, and yet I couldn't walk out because I would have embarrassed people. So I had to stay until about 7:30, and by that time, it was a Friday night. There was no way on God's earth I was going to get my plane from Newark back to Cleveland. Actually, I'm sorry, it was Thursday night. I had to teach a class the next morning at 8 o'clock. And in medical schools, you know, you don't miss your lectures or you get in a lot of hot water.
Yeah, I can imagine.
So I made it over to the Port Authority building on 8th Avenue and 43rd Street. It was about 8:30 or so, and I got in the bus, a nice big crowded bus, Trailways. And the driver turns around, he looks at us, he says, "Well, air conditioner is busted." Everybody groans. He asks us, "We really want to go to Cleveland?" Well, we said, "Yeah." And the guy pulled out of the Port Authority building. And just a few minutes later, some kid tapped me on the back of the shoulder from the seat behind me, asked me, "Sir, are we in Cleveland yet?" I said, "No, not yet, but I'll let you know." And he tapped me on the shoulder every 10 or 15 minutes all the way to Ohio.
Well, this was a mentally challenged kid in some way,
he had
right?
little Down syndrome.
Okay.
And he was very affable, very kind, very caring. You know, the silver lining in a lot of those folks is that they do have a sense of joyful generosity. And he certainly had it, and he was a pleasure. I wasn't bothered by him. He was like taking your 8 or 9 year old child for a drive from Cleveland to Columbus, Ohio. You know, every once in a while, you're going to get a tap on the shoulder, "Dad, are we there yet?"
Yeah.
And the guy in front of me had two little boys. I think they were about 5 years old. Now, every half hour, this guy would jump up out of his seat and pound his fist to the metal ceiling of the bus, making a big kabam. And so we got all the way to Milesburg, Pennsylvania. It had to have been about 4:30 or 5 in the morning. And Milesburg, Pennsylvania is a stopover for the buses. So the bus drove in to Milesburg, and we stopped at the cantina. Well, it turns out the security wouldn't let this fellow with his two boys back on the bus because he was too violent. He was frightening everybody. And so we pulled out, and there was that fellow with his boys just screaming and yelling and kicking the wall. That was a pretty tough sight. And so we got out on Route 80 again, the fellow behind me with the Down syndrome tapped me on the shoulder, and he asked me, "Sir, are we in Cleveland yet?" Well, we got to Cleveland. It was about 7:15 or so, 7:30, and I hugged that guy, and we said goodbye, and he went off with some friends who had met him there. I made my lecture, but the moral of the story is, you know, if you don't want to get stuck in Milesburg, stay away from anger, hostility, resentment, bitterness, and all those negative emotions, because they ain't going to do you much good.
Okay. Okay. But there was also something, I think, that you took from that Down syndrome guy tapping you on the shoulder.
Oh yeah, basically, you know, if you want to get to Cleveland, do it with love. In other words, you know, he was a perfect example of somebody who may not have been cognitively flourishing. You know, he obviously had some cognitive developmental disabilities, but he was profoundly loving, and I think he reveals to us that which is most fundamentally human, that which is really at the essence of being human, and that we sometimes forget about.
Mm-hmm. Now, we all seek happiness. What's your prescription for happiness?
Do unto others. You know, Viktor Frankl impresses me. You know, he says you can't pursue happiness directly. It's a byproduct of serving others. You know, you could be surrounded by 100 people who love you and adore you, including doting parents. And I'm telling you, you will not be happy until you learn to actually give love. You can receive all the praise and adulation and affirmation on earth, but it's when you really begin to discover, stumble on the happiness of giving, that you really discover the core and the root of goodness.
Yes,
happiness.
Yeah, in your book you say, give daily in small ways and you'll be happier. Give and you will be healthier. Give and you will live longer. And then you go on to say, giving is good medicine. So what's behind that statement, giving is good medicine?
Well, it's not just that you're going to be happier on the whole, and there's a lot of science to support that. In fact, you know, most Americans say 76% of Americans answer that to a Time CNN poll question, that the thing that makes the most happy in life is contributing to the lives of others.
Mm-hmm.
The only things that top that are the 78% who say that their children make them happy and the 77% who say that friends make them happy. So in general, it's these opportunities to give to others, to be pro-social, to be contributing to the lives of others, that seems to be a formula for happiness. And it's not that different than the images you get in an Ebenezer Scrooge, who's completely miserable while he's isolated and lonely and selfish. And as he becomes a little more giving, he gets happier. And by the end of the story, he's up and down the streets of some unidentified city in England. And he's the happiest man around. He's also helping everybody in sight.
Yes. Now, again, expand a little bit on the idea that giving is good medicine. I mean, there's
medicine. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Oh, sure. Well, listen, I'm going to be very clear about this. Just to put a context here, there's an old personality inventory that's been used in America for many years, the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory.
Sure, the MMPI.
MMPI. So a fellow at Duke named Reynolds Williams in the 1990s took 50 questions from the MMPI that he most associated with hostility. I mean cynicism, aggressiveness, anger, bitterness, etc. He called this a hostility scale. And he looked at those MMPI tests that were taken in 1950, okay?
Yes.
And what he found was we were in the top 25% of the hostility scale had a death rate of 20% by age 50.
Wow.
Those who were in the lower 25% of the hostility scale had a 2 to 4% death rate.
Wow.
And so basically a lot of hostile emotions, rage, bitterness, rumination, those things are like acid metal. They corrode the body. In these studies, most of those folks who were dying at age 50 were dying of vascular disease and coronary problems. And so that's something to recognize. But they were also more susceptible to cancer and some other important diseases. So that's kind of interesting. And then you get these remarkable studies in nursing homes, where once you untie people in nursing homes. You let them free of their restraints, and you allow them a certain amount of freedom in just everyday activities, including decision-making, they have half the death rate over a five-year period than those who, in fact, are not given these opportunities. So in general terms, emotions can be very destructive, not just of psychological health, but of physical health. And so what we show in a study that was conducted by Paul Wink, for example, at Wellesley in the Massachusetts area, younger people from the 1920s who have been followed every 10 years of their lives very extensively by interview teams and with their medical records in hand, these people, the ones who as youngsters, this study started in about 1930 when these people, the subjects were only in their teens or college age, the ones who identified an altruistic purpose, I want to use my talents to help humanity, they were, first of all, happier over the course of their lives by self-report. They were shielded from depression dramatically, and they were shielded from stress-induced illnesses. Odds are they'd even live a little longer. So in general, it's good to be good. We seem to be wired for it. And when we don't behave in a kind of generous way, it does us harm.
Well, that's interesting, and there's plenty of other research that you cite in the book that goes along to support that as well.
Right.
In your chapter on the love and longevity scale, you know, speaking of the MMPI, you, I guess you worked with some other people to develop a more positively oriented kind of instrument called the love and longevity scale, and you talk about the four domains of giving and the 10 ways of giving. So I want to go into that. What are these four domains? If you want to talk about the scale some, you can talk about that. And then tell us about these four domains of giving.
Well, the domains are, you know, the nearest and the dearest, typically, you know, family members and friends. And then you get to neighborhood. You get to eventually, you know, workplace, schools, community, and then finally you get to the neediest, to all humanity, to the kind of giving that people do for those who just need it, even if they're perfect strangers. And so it's this balance between family, friendship, neighborhood, community, and then all humanity. It's this sense of wanting to be intentional about the ways of love in all those different domains or spheres of activity.
So the domains are...
That's what that's all about.
Yeah, so the domains really are like four expanding circles out from us, sort of with broader and broader reach. Now, what about the love and longevity scale? What's that about?
Well, you know, there are 10 ways of giving that are emphasized in the book and that, you know, I've been writing about for many years. Attentive listening is one. Loyalty is another. It's hard to imagine loving somebody if you're not at all loyal to them, you know.
Yeah.
It's hard to imagine loving somebody if you don't listen to them attentively. The ways of love are really important to reflect on. It's as though love is the hub of a wheel, and all these manifestations of love are the spokes. So respect is a form of love. Compassion is a form of love for those who are suffering. It's an immediate response to the suffering. Forgiveness is a form of love for those who need forgiveness. Love takes many different forms and varieties. Creativity is a form of love. People oftentimes use their creativity to help the people around them, to give to the ones that they care about. And so at the end of every chapter, of every way of giving, of every way of love, there's a 20-item scale that a person can take, and it gives them a sense of whether they're in the top or the second or the third or the bottom tier in that particular way of giving. Now, the scales are scientifically validated in the sense that scales are. They were all tested and analyzed among students at the University of Miami with the help of Mike McCullough, who's a real expert in scale development. They give you a good sense of your strengths. They give you a picture of your life of love in all the domains and in all the ways of love. And hopefully you can build on your strengths, because most people do have strengths. But on the other hand, if you've got some glaring weaknesses that you might be able to attend to, it's a good idea to work on those as well.
Well, you call it the love and longevity scale. What's the longevity part?
Well, that's a bold name for the scale, but the point is that people who are generous in giving do, on average, tend to live longer than those who are selfish. That's very well demonstrated in studies on older adults, whether the researchers at Stanford or Berkeley or University of Michigan are looking at formalized volunteering activities or informal helping activities. People who are helpers tend to live longer. Again, sometimes the good die young, like Billy Joel sang it. But as a generalization, statistically, the fact of the matter is that the good will typically be happier and healthier and live a little longer life. Maybe in some studies, 3 or 4 or 5 years longer on average than those who are at the low end of the giving scales. So what's going on there? I think it's really a matter less of action than of psychological and emotional state. When we are less focused and obsessed with the self and its problems and more centered on others, I think there is a process of freedom involved there. I think people discover joy and a peace of mind when they reach out to others, and they don't have that joy and peace of mind when they're just totally wrapped up in themselves.
Huh, that makes me wonder if anybody has tried this in a sort of disciplined way as a treatment for, say, depression. Prescribe giving or to get patients engaged.
Well, they did. See, yeah, so there is a little history here. You know, in the 1820s in America, the big six asylums were built. This is McLean Hospital in Boston, the Institute of Living in Hartford, the Philadelphia Asylum, and they were all designed in reaction to the way in which people with mental illness and melancholy were treated earlier on. They were basically kept in chains, restrained in hostile states. It was a horrible situation. But in 1820, a movement began called moral treatment. And the idea was that if you could just let these folks live together and allow them to have positive pro-social roles, that they would do well. So Olmsted, who designed Grand Central, Central Park in New York, designed the great sweeping lands of these asylums, and people would be able to, hey, milk the cows, paint the barn, just do positive things, contributing to the life of a community. And what they found was that melancholy subsided. And in modern days, you know, there's the clubhouse movement, which began in, I guess, the 1940s in New York, and it spread nationally, where people who are living in the communities, instead of in mental hospitals and the like, become members of these communities. They don't live in them, but they visit them most of the hours of the day. And the key thing is that they have positive chores, do things for others, and they pick those chores. So there's a certain amount of freedom and autonomy in the process. But this is important. And, you know, even take alcoholism. We have a study, which isn't in the book because it's too new, but we did fund it, In the 12-step program for Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12th step is help other people with alcoholism. And the folks who do that have a 40% recovery rate after 1 year of entering treatment. The ones who don't fulfill the 12th step, that is to say, help other people with alcoholism, they have only a 22% recovery rate. So across areas of disease, it turns out that cultivating compassion and doing unto others tends to be good for one's psychological and physical health.
Well, that's really interesting. You know, the way that you talk about the ways of giving, it triggered in me the idea of a spiritual path or like a yogic kind of path to enlightenment. You talk about the way of celebration, the way of courage, the way of forgiveness, the way of compassion. Right. So that was interesting to me. Maybe we could focus on some of those ways. For example, you have a whole chapter on the way of celebration, turning gratitude into action. Talk about that a bit.
Yeah, so, you know, gratitude, that deep sense of gratitude for the people around us and the kind of cosmic gratitude for many, it's reflected in most spiritual traditions, the attitude of gratitude for the universe we live in, for a generative planet Earth, for the beauty of nature, and so forth. Gratitude studies indicate that people who are grateful certainly self-report greater happiness, tend to be less anxious, and tend to be somewhat shielded from depression.
Yes.
Celebration is just a kind of gratitude with a special oomph. You know, we want to celebrate the major achievements of a person's life. We want to express our thanks to them. We want to buy them a cake. We want to throw a party. We want to do something special for them. That is an expression of love. Love isn't all about, this is where I'm not a Buddhist, although I love Buddhism, but this is where love is not just about compassion. Compassion literally is an immediate response to the suffering of another human being. Well, that's a really important part of love, and thank heavens that we generally have it, although sociopaths don't, and we struggle sometimes at the interface between them and us. But by and large, compassion is incredibly important, and yet it's not the whole story of love, because another very important expression of love is just celebration. I mean, think about how dour an unrewarding life would be if we didn't celebrate our lives together, right?
Yeah.
So celebration matters.
I want to make sure I understood that piece about that's why I'm not a Buddhist. You said the Buddhists talk about compassion, but what's the second piece that they leave out?
Well, compassion is one really important expression of love. It's one of 10 expressions of love, but it's only one of 10.
Okay.
And so, the Buddha goes out of his palace, and for the first time as he's out in the streets, he sees that people are really suffering. And he feels for the first time compassion toward that suffering. That's a wonderful, wonderful story. It makes a lot of sense. And so whenever I read a Buddhist statement on these kinds of themes, it's always a statement about compassion. But compassion is just, again, one form of love. Another form of love is what we call carefrontation, the ability to caringly confront destructive and self-destructive behaviors in others, and hanging on to people in that process and guiding them to a newer level of insight. That's important, too. When a social activist confronts in a loving way. Martin Luther King wrote his sermons, The Strength to Love. When somebody confronts social injustice out of love for those who are victims of that injustice, that's a form of love too. And so love can take many different forms, and compassion is one of the important and essential forms of love, but it's certainly not the whole story.
Okay. And we were talking about celebration, and I was surprised and delighted to read on page 37 of your book, you actually talk about an incident with, I guess, a mutual friend or two friends who actually I've interviewed on this show. Longtime listeners will remember my interview with Doctors Gail and Dale Ironson, and you talking about, you have a point here that says, celebrate now. And you write, I recently spoke with a psychologist, Dale Ironson, PhD, who with his sister, the psychiatrist and psychologist Gail Ironson, MD, PhD of the University of Miami, is studying spiritual transformation in AIDS patients. Hopefully, I have some listeners who will remember that. And you go on to say, I asked him what he wanted to celebrate at that very moment, and he did not hesitate to reel off a list. My nice conversation with you, my many friends, the beautiful day, and the delicious food I eat when people in other places are starving, and the incredible age I'm living in with all the fantastic discoveries going on. So you go on to say, keep your celebration list of journal, list or journal easily available and add to it when you have the time and inclination. So I was delighted to see you quoting my good friend there. And in fact, that is very characteristic of my friend Dale, that he is mindful to celebrate.
It's really important. It's really important. You know, I'm a married guy. I've been married for 25 years. I got an anniversary coming up in about a week and a half. And, you know, we're going to celebrate that.
Yeah.
And, you know, we celebrate birthdays. We celebrate graduations, you know, the smile and the joy involved. But just every day, you know, we need to have an attitude of celebration and gratitude for the people and the world around us. And boy, when we do that, you know, people keep gratitude journals and they report, you know, enhanced degrees of happiness. You know, it's important. And look at the, gosh, there isn't a scripture in any world religious tradition that doesn't spend a lot of time giving thanks for the universe.
I've certainly found it to be a powerful technique. Years ago, one of my colleagues, and now he denies it, he doesn't remember it, but I'm sure he's the one who suggested to me the idea of before falling asleep at night, laying in bed, to kind of review the day and to review the interactions to be grateful for. And
Yes. Boy,
and the times I've done that, you know, anytime I remember to do that and I take the time to look back over the day, I discover it's kind of a discovery process as well as an affirmation process. I realize, hey, you know, that was wonderful when so-and-so said such-and-such, or the way somebody looked at me, or, you know, or that I was able to help someone out, you know, just to review those incidents.
Oh, I think that kind of internal review after the day is really important.
Mm-hmm.
And I do that when I get the chance, most days, mm-hmm. as soon as I get up in the morning. You know, I get up pretty early. And I try to spend just, 15 or 20 minutes visualizing the interactions that I know I have planned for the day. And I ask myself, you know, there's Tom, you know, now boy, when I meet Tom, I want to make sure that, Tom has a sense of, that I'm loyal to him, you know, or I want to make sure that, Sally, who just lost a job, knows that I'm there with her, that I want to try to help her and be generative and useful to her and finding a new job. You know, in the book Mirth, laughter is an expression of love. Well-placed, well-timed humor can help people completely reframe their view of the future. It's a way of giving, of uplifting the people around us. And you know, it's hard to find the Dalai Lama or Mother Teresa talking about love or compassion without also talking about joy and mirth. And so, I think about whether someone really needs a smile and a clever one-liner that will just make their day. And so I think about all the people I'm going to meet, and, I try to anticipate the kind of expressions of love that are most beneficial for them.
Well, that's a wonderful suggestion. And just to put you on the spot here, I'm wondering if you thought about this interview this morning before it came up, and if you had any intention that you wanted to express as you thought about it.
Well, you know what? Interesting. Actually, because I drove down to Cincinnati and back yesterday, which was a full 8 hours of driving, and I got in late last night, and I had to get up super early this morning to teach a medical class of first-year students. This is one of those days, quite honestly, when I just got out of my routine and didn't do the kind of early day visualization that I typically would do otherwise. Yesterday, as I was driving on Route 71 in my car and had my appointment book open on the passenger seat beside me, I did very carefully look over all my activities for today. So I thought about the students I would be meeting with from 8 to 10 and, you know, how I would want to interact with them and how I would want to express love with that group. I thought about some people I needed to respond to by email, talking with someone like yourself, and then there are lots of other things going on in the day as well. Of course, my wife and my son Andrew are visiting Japan for 2 weeks, and so I don't have to worry too much about the nearest and the dearest.
Yeah. Now, our mutual friend Dale Aronson, who I've mentioned now a couple of times, he mentioned to me that you are going to be speaking before the U.S. Congress in October.
October 9th.
Yeah, what's that about?
Well, it's a fall spiritual retreat, and, you know, it's run out of the chaplain's office there. It's voluntary, so not all the congressmen attend. I heard that about 150, maybe 200 do, congressmen and senators.
Wow.
And what I'm going to do is talk with them about the 10 ways of love, of giving, including, respect, civility,
Yes.
But lots of other things. And that'll be based on the book, the new book, Why Good Things Happen to Good People. And I'm waiving my any speaker's fee so that they can pick up a copy of the book and give it to everybody who attends.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, it's about time for us to wrap things up here. And as we do, I wonder if there are any last thoughts that you'd like to leave with our listeners.
Well, I'll tell you, I think love competes with a few other basic emotional states, anger, hostility, hatred, fear.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about the options, love looks pretty good. And if you can stay in that kind of positive energy, doesn't mean that you're not going to have to address evil in the world. It's not that you're going to be able to avoid confrontations that will just come your way, and you don't have to necessarily look for them, there's real hurt in the world, and hurt people, I like to say. But, in the final analysis, if we can pass the torch of love to the people around us, if we can light a candle in the darkness, if we can encourage our kids to live lives of love, they are going to live happier and healthier, and odds are longer lives. And this is all that spirituality comes down to, in my view. In the end, every great tradition teaches a transformation, from call it I it to I thou. When I it, you treat people only because they contribute to your little agendas, and I thou, you discover a sense of awe before the beauty of another person, and you take them into account in a deeper and fuller sense. And there's still an I, there's an I it and I thou. There's still an I, but it's a deeper, a truer, a more fulfilled, a happier I. Yeah, sometimes, you look at the life of a Martin Luther King or a Dietrich Bonhoeffer, and you know, their lives do get cut short because of the special work that they seem to be put on the earth to do. But it's not that they were seeking an early end, but somehow it found them and they accepted it with courage. The idea of love being the source of buoyancy and fulfillment, that's the image I want. I don't want any of this arid, dry stuff, you know, the emaciated, masochistic do-gooder. I want us to understand scientifically that we're wired to do unto others. And when we do that, we experience a fuller life.
Boy, that's sure a different brand of psychology than I was initially exposed to as an undergraduate and that many students are still exposed to. And it's you're a wonderful embodiment of what I hope will be a growing force in psychology.
Well, thank you very, very much, Dan. It's a pleasure to be talking to you, and I wish everybody out there in California the very best. You know, I love the West Coast. I was actually out there in the summer of 69 as a 16-year-old out in the Bay Area.
That was a good time.
I was playing classical guitar in Hispanic restaurants in the Mission District.
Oh, wow.
And living with my cousin George, who'd been a Green Beret for a couple of tours of duty. He was a bit older than me. And really had an interesting time out there. Even went to college out west for a while.
Well, that's great. Although, I don't know if you're aware of it, but we have a worldwide audience. So people all over the world will be hearing this interview. So Dr. Stephen Post, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
All righty. Thanks. Wishing you well.
Okay. Thank you. I hope you enjoyed this interview with Stephen Post. I'm impressed by what a wonderful career he's created for himself. He started an institute where he gets to give away large sums of money to other researchers who are studying the best of human nature. Doesn't that sound like a job you'd like to have? And he gets to be the Johnny Appleseed of love and giving. I know in my own life that my deepest joys have come from service and giving. I was privileged to have a long career as a teacher, and I always experienced that as a giving sort of role. And I also feel that way about these podcasts that I've been doing. These are my gift to you, and in return, you've given me back so much in the way of support, encouragement, and appreciation. And then being the parent of four kids certainly helped me to grow into becoming more giving in ways that I might not have been stretched without that experience. I want to take this opportunity to share with you a financial giving opportunity that I'm involved in and that I'm quite excited about. Maybe you've heard about microloans, you know, the idea of lending small amounts of money to people in third world countries who are trying to get ahead with small-scale business projects. Well, I've discovered a wonderful organization called Kiva at www.kiva.org. That's K-I-V-A, Kilo, India, Victor, Alpha. The slogan on their website is Loans That Change Lives. And here's what I love about this site. You get to read the requests of people in third world countries who are asking for a loan to help grow their business, which might be something like selling in an outdoor market and they need cash to increase their inventory. Or perhaps they sell eggs and they need more hens to lay the eggs. So you're able to browse through their requests and find one that speaks to you, that you want to help. And then you can decide to give that person a loan through the website. And your loan will almost certainly be repaid in full, but you won't receive any interest on it. The statistics on the loan repayments are remarkable, something like 99-point-something%. And amazingly, none of your money goes to support the overhead of Kiva.com. None of it. It all goes to the person you're loaning it to. And once they've paid that money back, you can plow it into another loan. Or, if you want to, you can reclaim it to use in your own life. So the only thing you've given up is the use of that money for a while and whatever interest it might have earned. But the interest you earn in terms of the good feeling in your heart, knowing that you're helping another struggling soul, is worth far more than the few dollars your money would have earned. You can loan a big chunk or a small chunk to one person, or you can spread small chunks over a number of people. So do yourself a favor and at least visit www.kiva.org. If you're listening to this program, then you're far richer than the people requesting these loans. And I'll bet you can spare, say, $25 to get them closer to their goal. And you'll get more personal satisfaction from putting that $25 to work in this way than you would have if you'd used it for going to the movies or for cappuccinos. Personally, I'm going to try putting at least a little money to work this way each month and gradually build my portfolio there. And by the way, Kiva is not a sponsor of this show. They don't even know I'm making this plug on their behalf. I had an opportunity to hear a podcast interview with the young woman who started this organization. I think she'd make a great guest for a future show. She's not a psychologist, but in another way, she definitely is.
You want to learn about the inside and what makes us tick? You could find all the answers you need real quick. Get on the couch with Dr. Dave. Leave your worries behind. It'll all be fine. It's Shrink Wrap Radio. It's all in your mind. For insight into personal growth and the inner life, here's Shrink Wrap Radio with Dr. Dave.
Hey, everybody. I want to relate you to the fact that there is a new feature on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. We now have a poll feature there where I can pose questions and you can vote on the questions. You know, the American Psychological Association convention is coming up quite soon, and one of the issues that's going to be debated there has to do with whether or not the American Psychological Association's code of ethics should be rewritten to say that psychologists should no longer be allowed to be consultants to military interrogators, such as at Abu Ghraib and at Guantanamo. And this has been, this continues to be a hotly debated issue within psychology. So I have posted that question on the website. And so far, two people have found the poll and have voted. It reads, should the American Psychological Association rewrite its code of ethics to forbid psychologists to be involved in military prisoner interrogation? And there are two votes there right now. You'll need to go to shrinkwrapradio.com if you want to see how those two people voted and to cast your own vote. And then the other thing is, I hope to periodically post new questions, perhaps on a weekly basis, or maybe some of the questions like this would deserve to stay up somewhat longer than that. But one of the things that you can do is send me good ideas for questions that would be good to run a poll on. So if you've got some great ideas for poll questions, be sure to drop me a line and let me know. And by the way, I should mention where that poll can be found. It's on the right side of the page, on each page, in the green vertical bar on the right-hand side towards the bottom of the page. Once again, I want to mention my interview with Dr. John Clarkin of the Cornell Medical School on transference-focused therapy for borderline personality disorders. That's on my Wise Counsel podcast at wisecounselpodcast.com. So for all of you who are interested in all things psychoanalytic or psychotherapeutic, I think that's one that you'll really be interested in if you haven't heard it yet. Sadly, there are no new additions to the Frapper Map, and that's all I'll say about that. And I want to remind you that Shrink Wrap Radio is proudly sponsored by Podshow and by GoDaddy. And by using Shrink3 at checkout, you can get a discount on your next domain name purchase at GoDaddy.
This is Sarah Zeldman from SolutionsForBusyMoms.com. Since every mom has to be an amateur psychologist, I think Shrink Wrap Radio is a great solution for busy moms.
Sarah, thank you so much for that delightful transition. And if you're a busy mom out there, you'll definitely want to visit Sarah's website, which once again is www.solutionsforbusymoms.com. And it's a beautiful website with lots of things for busy moms, lots of ideas, and looks like recorded audio, and there's just a lot there. So I really want to support Sarah in her outreach to busy moms such as herself. Sarah also let me know that she's a life coach and her husband is a psychologist. And in an email, she suggested that an interesting show might be a discussion between a psychologist and a life coach about the pros and cons of these two different approaches to working with people. And I think indeed that would make for an interesting show. And I've suggested that maybe they might want to consider being my guests. So I'm still waiting to hear from them about that. And if they don't feel ready to take it on, I'm hoping that maybe they can refer me to another pair of coach and psychologists who'd be willing to discuss that with us. I think it's a great idea. I've received some pretty marvelous emails just recently, and so I think there's time to share a couple of them with you. The first comes from Amy, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I've been a regular listener to your show for a little over a year, and I've often thought about writing to you and thanking you for your contributions to my life and to psychology podcasting. Your show's hallmarks, the theme songs, the GoDaddy ads, and especially your voice, now create a notable relaxing effect on me. Whenever I put my earphones in and turn my iPod onto your podcast, I get a feeling of calm and excitement. I know that I'm going to learn quite a bit about something very interesting. Your questions have always been asked with a voice that I could relate to. I have really appreciated your ability to make me feel like the topics your guests bring to your show are not too over my head. You and your show have been major contributions to my introduction into the world of psychology. Around the time I began listening to your show, I was still teaching high school Italian and knew that I wanted to make a career change to another profession where I could help people tackle the more important issues in their lives. Your show gave me a base from which to learn about psychology and to think in an educated way about becoming a psychologist. In 2006, I stopped teaching and took the year off to explore several career options. Soon after, I began my prerequisites for graduate study in psychology, started some volunteer jobs in the area of psychology, and got myself an analyst. In September, I will be starting the PsyD program at the Wright Institute in Berkeley. I'm very excited and feel confident that this is the right path for me right now. Listening to your show helped me gain the tools I needed to make my choice. Thank you. On another note, would you consider recruiting more guests of the psychoanalytic bent? I realize that you've had many guests that talk about Freud and Jung, but maybe some talk about historical and modern object relations would round it out a bit. I also listen to your mentalhelp.net podcast and thoroughly enjoyed the recent spot on transference-focused psychotherapy for borderline personality disorder with Dr. John Clarkin. One more thing. I can't help but notice how supportive you are of listeners who might be prospective psychology careers or by asking your guests about their educational background and what they would have done if they hadn't studied psychology. I was recently recommended a book by a friend who is in career transition as well. She said the book tipped the scales for her towards a career in psychology as opposed to education. The name of the book is Letters to a Young Therapist by Mary Bray Pfeiffer. I just ordered it from Amazon, so I've not read it myself, but I'm confident that an interview with this author would be of great interest to that student or prospective student segment of your audience. You've made such a name for yourself that I bet you could entice her to be on the show. So thank you again, Dr. Dave. I will continue to listen to your show faithfully and recommend your show to my peers. Take care, Amy." Well, Amy, that letter certainly warms my heart, and I'm happy for any role that I might have played in what sounds like a very well-considered career change choice. So congratulations on on making that change, and also on the very careful and thoughtful way that you've gone about it by both taking prerequisites, by doing some volunteer work, and by getting into some therapy yourself. And that's really a good way to go about checking out whether or not this is the right direction for you to proceed in. I really appreciate this feedback about how useful the show has been to you as a prospective psychology student. As a matter of fact, I recently approached the head of Division II, which I think of the American Psychological Association, which is the division that's devoted to the teaching of psychology. And at the suggestion of another listener who is a psychology professor, I contacted the head of Division II, suggesting that they put this website on their website as a resource for teachers of psychology. Well, they were very polite, but they turned me down. And the basis for turning me down was that this show is not specifically addressing issues of how to teach psychology. But I was disappointed. I think they've missed a good bet, because I really wasn't offering it as a show on how to teach psychology, but rather as a good supplement to the teaching of psychology. I think they understood that, and they just didn't see this as being quite on target for what they needed. But it's the kind of feedback that you've given me, Amy, that keeps me thinking that there needs to be a home for this, a bigger home in the academic context. And I will keep trying to push for that. Now, pretty much in that same vein, I received a letter from longtime listener Jeff, who wrote, "Hi, Dr. Dave. During your 100th show, you mentioned your interest in giving the show a wider audience. This gave me an idea on how to broaden your reach. You said that you prepared some flyers promoting the show to hand out to your colleagues on various trips. I would like to suggest that you broaden this request for assistance to your listener base. The concept would involve preparing a PDF of a flyer or a couple of flyers and a print advertisement. Once completed, you would then add a section to your website where listeners could go to and download the flyers or the advertisement. The next step would be simply to ask your loyal and enthusiastic audience if they would care to post the flyer on any psych department bulletin boards that they may have access to. If one student in every third or fourth university participates, then you've covered a whole lot of territory. This could also be applied to other environments, social service departments, government agencies, religious institutions, etc. The idea behind the print ad is certainly secondary to the flyer posting request, but I thought that I would also include it. The purpose of the ad would be to provide editors with an advertisement that they could use to fill remnant space in their publications." So he says, if my guess is correct, you would find that a number of listeners would be more than happy to help you spread the shrink wrap gospel. Cheers, Jeff. And he includes, speaking of gospel, he includes a picture of, I think it's Martin Luther tacking up his notice on the door of the cathedral. Well, Jeff, what a great idea that is. Thank you so much for that idea, and I will do that. So I hope, in fact, that Jeff is right and that there are those of you out there who would be willing to download such a file from the website and then to print it up and to post it here and there and everywhere. So I'll let you know when I've got that up. I've got one that I sent off to Jeff for his approval, and I'm waiting to get his feedback on it. Now, I have to give a shout out to listener Tom Barbalay, who has two podcasts himself, Noble Ape and Biota.org podcasts. And I was a guest on, I think it was the Biota.org podcast. And both of his podcasts are concerned with artificial life. And he was interested in the perspective that I, as a psychologist, might have on artificial life. And I didn't have a whole lot to offer. And so I also referred to him to Doug Davis, who he also interviewed. There's a link to my interview on the media part of my website if you want to hear that interview. But at any rate, maybe many of you would be familiar with another podcast called Podcast 411, in which Rob Walsh interviews podcasters. And in fact, he interviewed me at one point a number of months ago, and there's a link to that interview as well on my site. Well, he recently interviewed Tom Barbalay, and I have to tell you, I've been listening to Rob Walsh's podcast 411 for about 2 years, and he always asks the podcasters that he's interviewing what their favorite podcasts are. What podcasts are they listening to? And for 2 years, I've been listening, and nobody has ever mentioned Shrink Wrap Radio. Well, Tom Barbalay was interviewed just this past week, and not only did Tom Barbalay mention Shrink Wrap Radio and Dr. Dave, but he mentioned it 5 or 6 times. So, Tom, thank you publicly so much. Finally, let me share one more email with you. This one comes from Nick, who writes, Dr. Dave, I just finished listening to your latest show, the one on sexuality, while on a long walk with one of my dogs down by the Ottawa River. Great stuff. As a longtime internet inhabitant, it was great to hear someone say it. The net is a perfect place to explore and develop a sexual identity. Usually we just hear complaints about pornography. There's much more to the web than that. You were wondering if you should do other shows on sexuality. I'm all for it. Personally, I've always found paraphilias fascinating. How does someone develop a specific fetish and keep it for life? Particularly some of the more and unusual fetishes, for example, giant women or men, like in the film Attack of the 50-Foot Woman, furries, being a bipedal anthropomorphic animal like Bugs Bunny, and ordinary latex balloons like you'd find at a birthday party. Many fetishes have online communities where people get together and discuss their particular kink. Part of it is exchanging photos and stories, but they also discuss ethics and other issues. For example, if you're sexually aroused by balloons, is it ethical to ask an attractive coworker to help you blow up balloons for the office staff party? Evidently, this is a question that balloon fetishists genuinely grapple with. I came across the above balloon story in a book called Deviant Desires, Incredibly Strange Sex by Catherine Gates. And then he gives me a couple of links to Catherine Gates' website. He says her upbeat, positive attitude towards sexuality and unusual fetishes would make for an interesting and unusual guest. I know your list of potential interviewees is long, but I'd love to hear what Catherine could do with you for an hour or so. Wink, wink. And he gives me her email address. Thanks for your wonderful shows. I'm a big fan and a regular listener, Nick. Well, Nick, I think that's a great idea. And so I have sent off an invitation to her. I haven't heard back from her yet, but I do think it would make for a fascinating show. Okay, I think that better wrap it up for the email for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave voicemails on Skype where our name is ShrinkPod. You can also leave voice messages by clicking on the My Chingo button on our website. And you can also leave voicemail on our phone at 206-337-0622. Thanks again to Dr. Stephen Post for reminding us about the importance of giving. That's it for now. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.